Okay, we're back. It's KOWS 107.3 FM, Occidental, California. It's maybe a minute and a half before 1 o'clock. And Eric McBay is on the line. Correct?
Hi there.
Hello. Welcome to Sonoma County.
Well, thanks very much for having me.
I haven't met you until now, in at least on the voice level, and just placing the call to you, I was quietly amused at how soft-spoken you are, because the book is so your writing is direct and fierce and passionate, and why not be soft-spoken?
Okay.
Let's see, where might we begin? Eric McBay, it is Eric, right? I'm pronouncing it correctly?
Yep, that's right.
You're my first Eric. And you are in Ontario.
Yeah.
Which is your home. Mm-hmm. And you are the author of, with Derek Jensen, of What We Leave Behind. And a few minutes ago I read a couple of the blurbs off the book. And, I will read the introduction off the book also. Writer, activist, and small-scale organic farmer, Eric McBay works to share information about community sufficiency and off-the-grid skills. That ought to do it. You want to add anything to that?
No, not much.
Okay. Well, let's dive right in. We're in big trouble, and it has fallen to us to fashion a successful response to our crisis and see if we can secure a future for future generations.
That's right.
So, where should we begin? Should we take it from the top? Would you like to make any introductory remarks so that we can all get oriented to generally to your style or your general perception or way of thinking about our crisis?
Sure. Well, I can talk a little about the motivation for a lot of my work, which is partly the knowledge that we're in the middle of what you could call an ecological apocalypse. Almost every biome on the planet is at or near collapse. So in the oceans, for example, 90% of the big fish have been wiped out in the last 50 years. Soil erosion and water drawdown is rampant all over the planet. And so this is not, you know, often science fiction writers or people looking at environmental issues will say, oh, you know, one day it's going to get really bad if we keep doing this. But, you know, industrial culture has been destroying the planet for a long time now, for more than 50 years if you're talking about petroleum-fueled culture, and for centuries if you're talking about coal-fueled culture, and then if you're talking about, you know, civilization that runs on agriculture, which basically means running on soil by using up soil, then for millennia. So the ecological crises that we're facing have been going on for a long time, and we're well into the damage, we're well into the destruction. But it's really been something that's growing exponentially and something that is coming to a head at this point in particular, partly because of exponential growth of consumption. So it's something that we can't really put off, especially because of global warming. You know, that's probably the biggest kind of trigger point, the biggest culminating crisis that bridges the different problems that we're facing. So in terms of global warming, we're reaching a point now where we're seeing certain indications of a runaway greenhouse effect. So what that means is, regardless of whether we keep burning fossil fuels or not, certain parts of the planet might actually become fossil fuel emitters themselves because they've been so damaged. So, for example, the boreal forest in Western Canada, in British Columbia and Alberta, because of increasing temperature and because of excessive logging, that area seems to become a net carbon emitter. So, you know, you expect forests to suck up carbon to cancel the greenhouse effect. But here, because it's gotten so warm, because the forests have become injured and because they've been taken over by pine beetles, by pests, they're actually dying faster than they can do that, so they're actually releasing carbon. And it's a similar problem in the far north, in the Arctic, where methane and carbon has been frozen into the tundra or into the bottom of the Arctic Ocean. And now because it's warming, that methane, those greenhouse gases, are being released, and that's making the problem worse and worse. So if you talk to climate scientists, they'll mostly tell you that we have a window of only a few years to act decisively before it becomes a runaway effect. So a runaway effect would mean, you know, if we stopped all of the cars, you know, all of the coal plants, we stopped burning any kind of fossil fuel, then you would still have a catastrophic runaway effect. So we're really in a very narrow window of time for effective action. Then, of course, on the other side, industrial civilization is also running out of many resources that are essential to its continuation, fossil fuel being one of them. So one of my first book was about peak oil, the idea that oil production is approaching or has probably passed at this point its all-time high, and that we've used half the oil, and production of oil, or extraction, as it's more accurately called, is going to decrease every year from now on. So that means that not only is industrial civilization unsustainable in the sense that it's destroying the planet, but it's unsustainable in the more basic, literal sense that it can't be sustained, it can't be continued. So we kind of have, in a sense, two problems. One of which is that the planet's being destroyed, and that our only, you know, it's our only means of supporting ourselves as organic creatures, as living beings. And the other is that for particularly humans, industrial humans who live and depend on industrial society, that rug is going to be pulled out from under us. Now, if we had, a population that was consonant with the number of people that the planet could sustainably support on an indefinite basis, and if we had an intact biosphere, then it wouldn't be as much of an issue for us to return to a more sustainable way of living. But we have these divergent problems where the planet is being destroyed such that it can support fewer and fewer people every year, whereas, industrial culture is becoming more unsustainable. More people are becoming part of it. More people are being on the planet. So we are really in two kinds of crises.
It seems that the nature of the crises is seeping more and more into the mainstream, which is good. But I don't think the same can be said for the severity of the crisis or the urgency of it.
I think that's true. I think that it's a lot of that is because people don't really live in what I would call the real world. When people talk about the real world, they talk about, you know, the economic world or the business world or television or CNN. So they're kind of dimly aware of these issues, but for most people living in a wealthier nation like Canada or the United States, their daily life has no real connection to the natural world. You know, most people live in cities. Some of us, like myself, are farmers, so we have that kind of connection. And we actually depend on climate and rainfall and soil integrity and so on. But most people really have no direct relationship with the natural world at all. And so the people who feel the impact of ecological destruction most keenly are people like indigenous people who are displaced or who have their food or land destroyed, peasant farmers living in the so-called third world whose wells are drying up. You know, half of the hand-dug wells in India are now dry because the aquifers are being drained so quickly by industry. That's up to 95% in some areas. So you have these situations where some people are certainly very aware of it, and obviously the majority of living creatures who are not humans are very aware of it, but those are the people who are, you know, kind of on the periphery or the margins of industrial civilization. And those of us who live inside of that civilization, it's ironic. You know, we have this access to the internet and to mass media and television that in theory should allow us to be better informed about what's going on in the world. But then that same spectacle is the same thing that keeps us distracted and prevents us from really absorbing the severity of the situation that we're in by, in some sense, isolating ourselves from that broader world.
Right. It's actually a psychiatric condition called dissociation. It's a pathology. It's an illness that resembles being in a trance or under a spell.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, humans are a cultural species. You know, a lot of animals will be able to walk within minutes of being born. And humans are very different from most living creatures in that respect, in that we need to be taught things. And our brains are very flexible. They're malleable. So we really need to have We need to be taught to make those relationships and to make those connections with other human beings and with the land, with other living creatures. And that's certainly what happens in indigenous and traditional cultures, but most of those have been deliberately attacked or deliberately marginalized or deliberately wiped out. And what you have left is this culture which frankly wants us to be dissociated. It wants people to be broken off into pieces because it doesn't want communities. It wants, you know, people who are isolated and so can be good laborers or good soldiers or whatever other role the dominant culture wants them to play.
It's a business model.
Uh-huh.
Essentially. That's really all it is. And it's the legacy of a long period of social organization that's been based on competition for resources, mm-hmm. talking about thousands and thousands of years. Mm-hmm. So we can hardly even imagine anything other than this. And that's one of the great stumbling blocks is reawakening our dream life and our imaginations and somehow remembering that it's good to be alive, that life is not a torment or a hell, you know, from which we're begging to be delivered from, in one form or another. So the requisite stimulus needs to be applied. We need some sort of a series of shocks to return us to our humanity or to our own inherent native consciousness of a living being, terrestrial living being. So I've heard the phrase death spiral. That's a pretty dramatic phrase, but I think it's absolutely accurate. I think we're in a fatal trajectory. We have yet to successfully fashion a successful response collectively and to disseminate it and have it begin to take a hold in our collective consciousness. We're up against a tremendous machine of misdirection and private interest and purposeful. There's this phrase, dumbing us down. I think we've been dumbed down systematically for the last 50 years at least, mm-hmm. to where it's very hard to find people who seem to be present and accounted for in the public. You go out in the public, and I'm always looking to strike up conversations with people. I kind of am like knocking on the door and saying, "Is anyone home? Are you paying attention? Do you have any sense of really what's going on beyond the general, you know, whatever passes for our news or our understanding of what we're involved in now?" I don't know if that's clear or not, but so. What I appreciate so much about your books is that it's to me, I'm just an average bear. It's kind of a little bit of shock therapy. It's a little stronger or a lot stronger. I feel that I'm being spoken to like, like I might be at least partially grown up, and I can bear the dreadful news that we're, you know, that there's an emergency and we're really, the family's in trouble, and, you know, can you help? Can I help? Or can you please pay attention, like that? Have you, do you feel that the book is getting a wide readership, or you, do you feel like you're making any sort of inroad or impact to speak of?
Well, I won't get the readership numbers in terms of sales for another couple of months, because the book just came out in the spring, but my sense is that it's being widely read. I mean, we've certainly got a lot of emails. I think that the bigger contact, might come from when, you know, for Derek or I, when we go to do a conference or a talk or something like that, when you actually get to connect with other people and to sit down and talk with them and maybe do some strategizing. Because, you know, a book is a book. It's, in some sense, it's imaginary. It's like anything you might read on the internet. It's not fully real until you apply its ideas or until you discuss, its ideas with another person, until it becomes a connection. Mm. So, Derek Jensen and Lier Keith and I do these conferences, called Deep Green Resistance, and we do these a few times a year and go to different cities. And spend a weekend with about 50 people and talk through a lot of these issues, and we have different, you know, scenarios and activities and games. And I think that in a group of people, that a lot of these ideas and this seriousness, this kind of honesty that you're talking about, the willingness to dialogue and address these serious problems.
Like grown-ups.
Pardon me?
Like grown-ups,
to be able to act like grown-ups, this is definitely taking hold, and that's really promising. And I think, you know, I've done a lot of different kinds of activism in social justice and environmentalism, and one of the things that I've given up on in that time is the idea of a timely mass movement for dealing with this crisis.
Right.
So, you know, you might be able to get a lot of people down to agree to stop using a certain kind of spray can because it's destroying the environment.
Right.
But these problems, these crises, are so deeply rooted in the industrial infrastructure, in industrial culture, in industrial civilization as a whole, that you really require a lot of deep-rooted change to fix that. And I don't think most people are going to be interested or willing to do that in a reasonable period of time, in the window for action that we were talking about.
Right.
But there are a lot of people who are taking it really seriously, and more, and I find that really promising. You know, the next book that that I'm working on right now, which is just being finished up, it's with Lier Keith and Derek Jensen. It's a book about strategy for the environmental movement, on effective strategy. So one of the things that we draw on a lot is historical resistance movements. So I spent, you know, years reading about different historical resistance movements and how they organized themselves and how they started and how they developed. And one of the things that you consistently see is that resistance movements, even at their strongest, are usually only a couple percent of the population.
Right.
And even in those few percent, you know, only a couple percent of people are actually, you know, combatants or frontliners of any kind. Most of the people in that percentage are part of what you might call a culture of resistance. They're, you know, part of a supporting matrix. So I think that we are on the right track. If that's how we're going to think about it, if we're willing to think about strategy that will work for that number of people and to develop that culture of resistance, then I think that we're on the right track. We need a lot more people, and we need people to be more organized and more serious, but I'm impressed at how many people are moving in the right direction when I go to some of these conferences and when I talk to people. It's clear that there's a lot of movement and a lot of development happening.
Right. Why would Bill McKibben call the book occasionally unfair?
I didn't actually talk to him, so I'm not sure exactly what he meant by that. He may have been talking about the green building section, where we criticize William McDonough for some of his architectural projects like putting a green roof on a truck factory, on a Ford truck factory, I believe, which we don't believe makes that truck factory ecologically sustainable. But, you know, obviously everyone has their own threshold for success. But we are trying to be, you know, honest and forthright in terms of what's necessary to save the planet. And some things just don't cut it.
Yeah, a lot of people seem satisfied with symbolic gestures.
Uh-huh.
Which is not going to cut it.
It's not. But, you know, this is another thing that we came across studying the history of resistance movements. So one of the resistance movements that I studied a lot was the French resistance to the Nazi occupation, which is, you know, very well documented. There's lots of survivors, lots of communications, lots of books about it. And one of the things that what happened when they were initially occupied, when the Nazis initially invaded, was that people were kind of stunned. They were kind of surprised. And so when it came down to resistance, a lot of people were like, "Ooh, I don't know." And some people who were opposed to the Nazis said, "Well, you know, they've taken over. We might as well just try to convince them to do things that are better for us. And maybe that will work." Of course, that didn't really work. You know, they were taking people away for slave labor and that sort of thing. And some people were saying, "Well, you know, we really need to stick to symbolic or spiritual action because that's the only thing that's actually going to work. The Nazis are so powerful. There's, you know, we better just stick to, you know, praying and that sort of thing." And so they had underground newspapers, but for most people that was the biggest risk that they were willing to take right at the beginning. And over the next couple of years, the resistance got more organized, it got better training, it recruited. But really, one of the big turning points happened around 1943. So you had all of a sudden this spate of resistance attacks on Nazi personnel and on Nazi equipment. And, you know, you had these religious-based underground newspapers that previously had said, you know, only spiritual resistance is okay, or, you know, the elegance of Parisian women constitutes resistance. All of a sudden they were publishing editorials saying, you know, it's the duty of every French person to kill Nazis or to kill, you know, the French paramilitaries who are working for the Nazis. And so this change came about in large part because in 1943 it looked like Germany might actually lose the war. And I think we can draw a lot of parallels to our own situation. So, you know, it was as you were saying earlier, you know, there's a sense in which a culture or a life outside of industrial civilization, outside of the dominant culture, is unthinkable. Because it's spread so wide, so rapidly, because it's destroyed so many of the things that went before. But now a lot of us can see the cracks in the facade, you know, things
right.
Like oil, things like, well, that, you know, the world is running out of fish and water. Now it's starting to look like, you know, industrial civilization isn't going to last forever.
Right, it's starting to look like this could be real.
Exactly. So I think we're in a situation now where the resistance has a window here where it can start to grow. Because there are these cracks, because it looks like industrial civilization is not going to last forever. So instead of saying, you know, "Oh, well, we better all buy compact fluorescents and recycle our cans," we're thinking, "Well, this culture is not going to be around forever. And if we're going to survive on this planet, if this planet is going to survive and support life of any kind, then we better do something now."
Right. Just as an aside, there was a French filmmaker named, I think it was Jean-Pierre Melville, and they just recently, about a year ago, they released a classic of his that had been lost or whatever, called Army of Shadows.
Uh-huh.
And it's a beautiful, beautiful film about the French resistance. Just wanted to throw that in.
It's an amazing film. I would recommend it. I saw it last year, I guess it was.
Yeah.
And what's interesting about that film in particular is that it's pretty forth. It's not, you know, a glorification of these wonderful days in the resistance.
Right.
It's pretty blunt about what it was like for a lot of people. You know, this wasn't a heroic experience during the undertaking. It was pretty nasty.
Right. It wasn't an adolescent dream.
No.
Well, we're like fish in water, and we don't realize that we're in water. We don't know the medium we're swimming in because it's all we've ever known. And the more it's thrown into relief, the more I really believe that it's within us to come to our senses and to remember to return to who we really are, which is.
There's another great line about the French Resistance, because you know before World War II, a lot of resistance movements were anti-colonial movements. They were an entire people who were resisting one power coming in.
Right.
Whereas in the French situation, it was a little different because you had the Nazis came in and they took over the kind of apparatus. So you had segments of French society resisting against other segments of French society. So you had this resistance movement that was separate from a cultural or ethnic group. So one of the great lines that I read during my research was, before resistance could be undertaken, it had to be invented. Mm. So, you know, resistance was unthinkable before a certain point. And in a sense, we're actually better off, you know, because lots of sustainable, egalitarian cultures have existed on this planet. We don't have to reinvent the wheel. You know, there are countless sustainable, egalitarian cultures that have existed that we can use as models. And I'm not saying we should imitate them. I'm not saying, you know, we should appropriate culture from indigenous people and try to pass it off as our own. I'm talking about, you know, the basic models of society, of, you know, small accountable groups, polycultural ways of getting food and hunting and fishing and so on. So in that sense, we more have to recapture in cultural terms what has already been developed over thousands or millions of years, but that's been suppressed or that people have attempted to destroy. And, you know, a lot of it is, it's interesting because once you get to that point, I think part of the key, one of the key things we have to do is to break our identification with a dominant culture and to realize that there are so many other ways of living. And once we get to that point, you know, it's not this deep existential issue to try to get outside of this culture. It's more of a technical one. You have to learn different skills, you have to pay attention to the land, you have to build a community and that sort of thing. So it's really much more, you know, it's this concrete kind of tangible work that has to be done.
Right. This is a real difficult sticking point. I suspect that many of us feel that that we would be disloyal or that we would be betraying our country if we were to look past the business as usual and start to question some of the fundamentals of the way we live. I think we've been acculturated or hypnotized as to remain perpetually children and to defer to our authorities and to basically go along for the ride. And I think it's a fatal circumstance at this stage of the game.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm all in favor of more courage from more people to do the work of penetrating the mirage or the flow that is taking us right down the drain with us. So I've been talking pretty much nonstop about Lierre Keith's new book, which has absolutely at first it shocked me, and then like about 2 seconds later, I realized that I was thrilled because it is such a demystifier and such a dehypnotizer.
Mm-hmm.
And I found in an instant, well, as long as it took me to read this book, originally I got a hold of the book and I thought, well, I'm just going to wolf this book down. And it just slowed me right down. And I read one sentence at a time with my jaw half open. And I knew pretty quickly that I was in the company of something, of a different order.
Mm-hmm.
And I read the book, carefully. And I've been so grateful to it in the 3 weeks that it's been, that I've ingested it, that I've taken it in. It had absolutely changed. I didn't know before I read this book. I didn't know what she is showing us
mm-hmm.
so clearly. And you know, when the bell rings, when the bell of truth rings, it's unmistakable. You hear truth, all of us. I know this to be true, that when we hear the truth of something, we know it instantly. And it's like case closed. This is not a reasoned opinion or a particular, looking at something from a particular angle. This is the very core of the thing itself. And I know you did the design layout for the book, and it's beautiful. And she talks about the cave paintings of rumen and animals and that sort of thing. The whole book has just, thrilled me, because what we were talking about a little while ago is that we've dilly-dallied so long, or we've remained in this kind of adolescent dissociation for so long that we've come to the point now where we pretty much have to turn on a dime.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that's what her book and other books and your book and a lot of other books are shifting into another gear. They're less polite and more urgent and more truthful. And we need this like nobody's business. You know, we cannot continue to be this media culture. I talked to this man this morning in a store I go to get a newspaper, and he was asking me about Afghanistan, and I was just stunned. It's like, what the hell are you talking about? You know, you watch TV, and now you're like, we're all playing this game where we're all invited to be experts on the great issues of the day, and you know, and he was asking me if I thought we should send more troops to Afghanistan, and I thought I was in the loony bin. It's like, please, you know, oh dear,
yeah,
save me, Eric. Continue, please. Oh dear, oh dear, oh dear. What are we going to do? I mean, there's honest to God, there's every likelihood, or there's every possibility, that it is too late for us, that we have just failed to take up our mature human responsibility, even in the face of all these crises, of all these warnings. We're still not taking it on, and when I say we, I mean the general population, or the great large percentage of people. You spoke earlier about maybe 2% or something like that. It's like, my God, can't we get 5 or 10%? I mean, we're supposed to be men and women. And where are we? What are we doing?
Well, a couple of things. I agree that for some it's too late. You know, it's too late for the passenger pigeon. It's too late for the great auk. There are many, many species who've already gone extinct. But I think in a lot of the kind of high-level stuff like global warming, I don't think it's too late to reverse that if we can act quickly and effectively. And part of that is, you know, you talked about Lierre's great book, The Vegetarian Myth. One of the things she says is that if all of the farms west of the Mississippi were turned from
east of the Mississippi
grain farms into polycultural, perennial farms.
Right, east of the Mississippi.
They would build soil and absorb carbon, and then so the United States would become a negative carbon emitter. It would start to absorb carbon.
Right.
So,
and equalize and neutralize all the SUVs and all the excuse me. Go ahead. Very dramatic. Please.
So it's pretty dramatic. So that's the case with.
Will you say that again, please? Can I ask you to say that again because I interrupted you six times?
Sure. So if all of the farms west of the Mississippi.
East of the Mississippi. East.
East? East.
I believe so. Yes.
Okay. East of the Mississippi were turned into perennial polyculture farms, then they would turn the U.S. into a net carbon, sequesterer. It would no longer be emitting carbon, even with all of the automobiles and so on.
Right, and we can grow topsoil.
Mm-hmm. And so that's the case with, I think, many different biomes around the world. You know, they've been cleared, they've been plowed, they've had their topsoil and their humus destroyed. But nature is very good at recovering, and it's very good at filling up damaged areas with life again. So I do think that that we can avoid runaway global warming if we act decisively, that nature is pretty good at solving these problems.
Right.
So in that sense, I don't think it's too late. And, you know, there's certainly groups like MEND, the Movement for the Emancipation of the Niger Delta in Nigeria, that have been very successful at reducing fossil fuel consumption by 70%. So that's a resistance group there that's been, you know, been working for indigenous people and fighting for indigenous people. So it's certainly not impossible. It's really more of a technical question in a lot of ways. And in terms of percentages of people, it's true that more people should be acting at this point. More, it would be great to have 10%. But I think that most people are in this way of power and in this way of the dominant culture. And, you know, if you look at a book called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions by I believe Thomas Kuhn,
right.
He looked at how scientific theories changed and how scientific paradigms changed over time.
Right.
So how, say, you know, Newtonian physics gave way to relativistic physics and after Einstein. And what he basically concluded was not that existing scientists were convinced for these, you know, drastically different theories or different paradigms, but basically that the old scientists died out or retired and the new ones coming up had been already exposed to the ideas.
Right.
So there's a certain amount of time lag that's to be expected with any kind of big cultural change or any big paradigm change. That's maybe a generation and maybe more. And another thing is, when I was researching resistance in Germany, which there was not much of, unfortunately, during the Nazi regime, one of the things I came across was a survey from 1953 about resistance, just a public opinion survey, where some surveyors went around asking people, well, do you think that resistance to Hitler during the Nazi regime, given given the crimes that we knew he committed, this was after Nuremberg and so on, so the concentration camps and the medical trials, this was public knowledge, do you think that resistance would have been acceptable? And most people said no. Something like 25% said resistance was acceptable or resistance would have been acceptable. And, of course, this is different from saying, you know, would you have carried out resistance if you known what was going on in the concentration camp?
Oh, that's a different
equation. Yeah, obviously most people wouldn't have because, well, you know, they probably, there's a good chance they would have died and that their families might have died also.
Right.
But then another question that people were asked after that was, if it was during a war, do you think it would have been okay to resist? Which, I mean, the Nazis were always at war. Any empire is always at war. The number dropped to something like 10 or 15% said it was acceptable to resist. So I think that's, you know, and obviously those numbers are much higher than they would have been if they did a public opinion survey in 1943. But what I find interesting about it is this idea that, you know, there's this idea that you have to build a mass movement, which comes out of things like, in the United States, comes out of things like civil rights, which, you know, needed to be a mass movement and should have been and was a mass movement in order to be successful. But I think that there are also situations when the culture or when those in power have such a strong hold on the minds of regular people that that's not enough and that's not going to happen, and that you're not going to have mass support for effective resistance until after that culture has already been defeated, or until after that those in power have been defeated. And, you know, that's what happened in Germany. You would never see a mass movement against Hitler, but years afterward, then you might see that public support if, you know, Hitler, if you managed to defeat Hitler in the interim.
Right, and that was 40 years ago, and it might as well be 400 years ago, because we're in a state of acceleration, and it's a very different world we live in now than in the 60s or the early 70s or something like that. And I have a lot of arguments with the local activist groups who seem to be still acting out of a paradigm that I think has receded into the past and is no longer necessarily the place to stand. Could you say a little bit about In the Wake?
Sure. So inthewake.org is a website I started in 2003. It's subtitled a manual in progress for outliving civilization. And I started this basically to collect information about different ways of living off the grid or different ways of meeting basic needs off the grid, you know, water, power, food, that sort of thing. And so it's just kind of a website that collects different ways of meeting these needs for purifying water and so on. And that website and the illustrations that I put up there were partly collected to become my first book, Peak Oil Survival. So I worked on that for several years and had a number of different people who were collaborators or assistants on different parts of the project. And fortunately, between, I guess, the time in the around the turn of the millennium when I started working on those things and around 2005, things like peak oil had become somewhat common knowledge, and a lot of people were working on those issues, so I started to focus my energies on a lot of the things that I write about in What We Leave Behind and what we're working on in the strategy book, which is effective strategies for resistance.
Right.
And the reason that I've changed my focus in that regard, increased my focus on resistance, is because effective resistance is a prerequisite for everything else. So, you know, I live on an organic farm, and, you know, on the farm we have dairy cattle and ducks and chickens and a vegetable garden and lots of pastures and that sort of thing. And I love going out to watch my ducks splash in their pond and the cows grazing on the fields. But none of that's possible in the long term unless we can avoid runaway global warming.
Right.
And none of that's possible in the long term unless we can stop this culture from destroying the planet. So things like knowing how to purify your own water are important, but we also need to focus on the most urgent threat, which at this point is that industrial civilization is killing the planet.
Right. You spoke earlier about in times of great crisis that some people in some cultures would resort to prayer or hoping that some new president will save us or something like that. And I'm very, very leery of this this phenomenon everywhere now that only seems to be growing of spiritual, finding a spiritual solution to our crisis. And there's something that doesn't click for me in all of this, there was a phrase that I heard someone use years ago called spiritual bypass. Mm. That one way that we can, one technique or one one resort that we can turn to ameliorate our anxieties or our sense of impotence or our greater fears is to turn to a kind of a magical thinking world that I feel is being manifested to a large degree in this spiritual movement. Mm-hmm. And I know it's not something that I tell people very often, because very likely they're on some spiritual path and heavily invested in it as well. So to be honest with you, I also have I bristle a little bit at the word resistance, because to me it seems to refer to an earlier time in our history. And I haven't really sat down and spent a lot of time really thinking about it, but I'd like to, if I could find, you know, I hardly have enough time to tie my shoes, but I'd like to find, another way to approach, the idea of, how we can organize ourselves or how we can, integrate and synthesize all the great themes of our crisis here I'm looking for something other than resistance, because it just seems so, I don't know, you know. But and if I find anything, I'll let you know. If I figure anything out, I'll let you know.
I think what we need is two-pronged, really. And one prong is resistance. And for resistance, I mean in a general sense, any effort to resist those in power, to go against those in power, to disrupt their systems of power. So, you know, it doesn't mean specifically the French Resistance or any historical resistance group. It's a general, I think it's generalizable across time, just the same way as power is. So, you know, the same way as that, as there is a Roman Empire and a Napoleonic Empire and an English Empire, you can have power across in many different time periods. And I think resistance is just one name for any kind of response to that exploitative or that conquering power. And resistance, I think, is one kind of prong of response to the situation that we're in. And I think we need two. And the other one is this building up of sustainable cultures and communities. And, you know, I talked about how my own focus has changed in terms of the website. But obviously I still live on an organic farm. You know, we raise our own food. We raise our own chickens. We grow our own vegetables and that sort of thing. And we put them in the root cellar over the winter or the freezer, or we can things. So, you know, it's not like I'm dismissing the importance of these pursuits. And we, you know, we train, new farmers, and we share skills with other people, and we have a very active local food movement here. So I think that prong is, a very important one. And I'm, you know, we're very practically focused, so we focus on these, concrete skills, which is different from some of the spiritual movements that you are talking about. You know, we have a very pragmatic focus. But I think that you need both sides. You need both halves of this. You need resistance movements, so you need social struggles, and you need to develop these, you know, egalitarian, sustainable, equitable communities. And of course the reason for that is, if you don't have a resistance movement, then those sustainable communities are going to be destroyed. I mean, that's what happened in the Americas. They were covered with sustainable communities, many of which were quite democratic and egalitarian, some a little bit lacking in that regard. And they were taken off guard and wiped out. So as long as there are people in the world who want to exploit or enslave others and take their land and take resources, you need people who are going to be willing and able to fight them, or other prong won't succeed.
Yeah, I remember hearing Derek talking about how people who resist do much better than people who don't.
Yes, in the in Sobibor, in the Jewish concentration camp Sobibor, and also in the Warsaw Ghetto, people who fought back had a higher survival rate than people who just went along with what the Nazis wanted.
I like to, I've been contemplating at some length getting beyond the us versus them structure, the oppositional flavor of the of our collective reality, and well, it's something I'd maybe like to share with you some other time, but it's a great time to be alive. There's never been a greater opportunity for us as a family, as a human family, to take a real giant step forward into the stages of real human maturity. I don't think we've done it yet, of really taking responsibility for our tenancy, for our appearance here on the earth. One family among millions, to be good neighbors and to just realize what's right in front of us, and is more and more being articulated by more and more people. There's reason. I'm a lot less depressed and defeated than I was 5 years ago or 10 years ago.
Good.
Or 20 years ago. Yeah, well, good for you, Ken. Well, it is. I'm invigorated by the nature of the challenge. And, I heard a great thing. I don't know if you ever heard this. Someone said that maturity is to be found in recapturing the seriousness of the child at play. And it took me a while to think about that and to realize, to remember the very real seriousness of the child at play, of the intent and the focus. And you spoke earlier about when I speculated that it might be too late for us, you responded with a very true picture of how the earth, it's in the nature of life to regenerate itself. We have self-healing bodies, and the earth is a self-healing body. And if we can allow the prairies and the forests and the wetlands to come back on their own accord, that this indeed can all happen. I feel that where we're fatally stuck is in our souls and psyches, is in the human collective soul and psyche, that's where the action is, and that's where the block is. We have, the Bioneers just went, did their conference this weekend, and there are just the most marvelous solutions to pretty much everything that isn't already permanently destroyed. That the spectacle of the regeneration of the planet is, it's hard to even imagine how happy we will all be when we turn our attention and put our shoulders to the wheel of beginning to take care of ourselves and beginning to take care of our home. It's just sanity itself. It's not something mystical, and it's not something that hasn't been discovered by some genius yet. It's the very essence of who we are. And it's so close, you know, so near yet so far, and it remains to be seen whether we're gonna succeed or not. And it's really quite a ride for all of us.
I agree, as you were saying earlier, that we live in a very decisive point in history, in human history, and really in ecological history. And I think that I would probably say that our main stumbling point is not necessarily in ourselves or in individual people, but in social structures and material systems of power. So I think that most people I know want to do what's right for the planet. They want to do things that are just for other people and that benefit their community. But there are material systems of power that prevent them from doing so, or, you know, that reward them for acting destructively to the planet or to other people.
Right. Well,
so I think that, you know, in some ways I'm an optimist about human nature, as I guess what I just said would indicate. I think that most people are basically good, or want to do good things. So I think one of our big jobs is to structure society in a way that allows people to express that, in a way that allows people to act in good ways that are beneficial to the land and that are beneficial to each other.
Right.
And so, you know, that means on one hand building communities where people can express those things, where people can act in those ways that are, you know, sustainable and equitable and so on. But our big hurdle right now is dismantling this society that's preventing people from doing that,
right,
that's obstructing people from doing that, and that's, you know, obstructing cultures from some cultures from developing maturity. I think that obviously, you know, most indigenous cultures were quite mature. They were, you know, thousands or tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of years old. And so they've developed very well and then were attacked or destroyed in most cases. So I think that, you know, a big hurdling point at this point is dismantling the systems of power that are preventing us from living sustainably, as
right,
you say.
Replacing them.
Yes. Replacing the relationships, replacing relationships of domination with relationships of, you know, interdependence and justice,
right,
and so on.
It's all a gestalt.
Uh-huh.
Well, it's doable, so let's do it.
Okay.
It's nice to talk to you. It's very good to talk to you.
And it's great to talk to you too. Thanks for having me on.
I appreciate you coming on and sharing yourself with the listeners here.
Thanks very much.
Speak to you again.
Talk to you again.
Be well.
You too.
Eric McBay from Ontario, a farmer and an activist and a writer and a thinker and a feeler and an asset to our family.